talking about specific heat magnetization of dysprosium titanate as kind of a model system that we've been studying, but a lot of these kind of measurements can be passed on to other kinds of materials that you might be working on, and I think a lot of the ideas will map onto other systems as well. This is a list of my collaborators. This is my group here. Hallie Revelle did the susceptibility measurements, and so did Luke, and David Pomeransky worked on the specific heat measurements. Jeff Quilliam is a former grad student who helped get this whole program going with the different measurements, and now he's at Sherbrooke with a faculty position. Patrick Cornelius is a theorist that we collaborated with, and I'll be presenting some of his Monte Carlo simulation results that are connected with the measurements that we were making. And the samples were grown by the McMaster group led by Bruce Gullin. Okay, yeah, so this is my group, and this is the dilution refrigerators that are kind of group members. They're key to doing these measurements. They're very temperamental, and we keep them running. This one was made actually in 1973, and this one here, they're both free. You get them, people throwing them out, and you fix them up. And so it's kind of actually not that expensive to do low temperature if you keep your eye open. Okay. So we're doing susceptibility measurements. A conventional susceptometer is very simple, where you make basically a transformer. You wrap two counterwound coils, and you put a sample in one of the coils that breaks the balance of the pickup between that and the primary. Okay. When you do it this way, you get an induced EMF that's proportional to the time derivative of the flux. This has a problem in that when you go to low frequencies, your signal is disappearing. And so for these kind of spin glasses and spin ice and things like that, where the frequencies become very low, this is not a very good way of making measurements. On the other hand, what's nice about this system is when you're working in high fields, this is compatible with working at 8 Tesla and higher fields. So that is one of the advantages of this kind of conventional system. What we work with is squids, and this is a schematic picture of two Josephson junctions in a loop that creates a DC squid. The bottom line is that you get a current to voltage characteristic that is dependent on the magnetic field, and there's a periodic function depending on a period with a period of a single flux quantum. And so if you bias the current at let's say an ideal location like this, you're going to get a voltage produced that is dependent on the amount of flux that's being applied to this squid loop. So it's basically the screening current here will add current to one of the junctions, modifying the current to voltage characteristic to create a sine wave. So what we do is we balance the squid at one of these steep locations here, and it'll give us a very sensitive flux to voltage conversion. And you don't know what the absolute flux is in there. You don't know what absolute zero field is, but what we can do is look at changes in the magnetic field. So it has the advantage of not having a frequency dependence as in the conventional pickup coil or the inductive pickup coil, but it has a disadvantage of not knowing where zero is. Okay, so many of you know this system probably better than me, but the idea behind dysprosium titanate is it's a real model system for spin ice. The idea here is that you have frustration, you have tetrahedra, where there's a corner sharing, the homeums are on these corners. The ground state of the system is two spins in, two spins out. When you get very cold, ideally you would have two in, two out in each of these tetrahedra, leaving a residual entropy. And so then it's very similar, it's analogous to water ice with the hydrogens pointing in, hydrogens pointing out. In this case, you have spins pointing in, spins pointing out. And so the theory was done by Harris and Bramwell for that. And then Ramirez et al. Did a very nice specific heat measurement where they measured the specific heat at low temperatures. And if you look at C over T, the area under the curve gives you the change in entropy. And if you assume, if you subtract the phonon term away, okay, and this is the magnetic contribution, you can then calculate the total entropy loss as you cool. And what they found is that it matched very nicely to actually water ice and the Pauling residual entropy that's found in water ice. It's the idea that all the tetrahedra are random, but they're all in a two in, two out state. Okay, so there's no long range order, but the two in, two out state is determined at these low temperatures. And so there's a residual entropy that they observe. I like plotting it this way, where I assume it's Arlon 2 at high temperatures where it's fully disordered. And then as you go down, you see where what it hits, and it hits this the value that Linus Pauling had come up with. Okay, so that's why it's dubbed spin ice. Another measurement that's very important for this system is the susceptibility measurement. This is two different groups came up with this in 2001, led by Matsuhira and also Peter Schiffer. And so what they use a squid in this case, and the idea behind susceptibility is that when you go to very high frequencies, the in-phase term, the moments cannot keep up, and so you have no signal in phase. So the response of the magnetic sample to the field, there's no response either way. And as you slow down your excitation, this is the frequency on a log graph, you'll end up seeing the magnetic moments will respond and eventually hit a DC limit where they're perfectly in line, in track with the excitation field. And so the chi double prime is the out of phase term, and basically is the derivative of this one. At the inflection point, you get a peak. And so as experimentalists, what we do to determine the effective time constant, a very convenient way of doing it, is finding the peak of the chi double prime and using that as a signature of the characteristic time of the system. It's really a distribution of time constants within the system. And in this slide here, what I'm showing is basically there's two ways of the experimentalists come up with the time constant. One is by looking at the chi double prime peak and looking at that go down in temperature. As you cool it, this peak goes to lower frequencies. And so that would be the characteristic time. Here it's being plotted frequency versus 1 over the temperature. And if it's an Arrhenius thermally activated process, you'd expect a linear slope. And so in this case here, these four points are determining something like a 10 Kelvin energy barrier to relaxation at low temperatures. This is 1 over T, so this is low temperature. This is one result where they do it a different way, where what they do is instead of scanning the frequency at a given temperature, they fix the frequency and scan the temperature. And you'll get a peak that way as well. What's happening here is that as the system gets slower for a given frequency, the response time of the magnetic moments is slowing down, and eventually the chi prime will just drop out. And so the peak there can be considered a characteristic frequency and temperature. But I don't like this way because it's an asymmetric peak. And so there's dependent on line shape when you're determining that peak. So that peak is not really as consistent. It depends on the line shape, and this is a nice symmetric peak. And so as you're cooling, you're not getting some kind of a systematic shift. And so in this case here, that data was taken with this temperature scan, and this was taken with a frequency scan. And I think that this is a more reliable way of looking at the data. Okay, so this is other work. Later on, Roger Melko and Michel Gingras and Hertog has a nice work where they were looking at Monte Carlo simulations. And what they did was they found that you can take the exchange term and the dipole term, and you can create an effective exchange model where what you're doing is you have a J effective, which is a combination of these, and that can properly represent the specific heat result. What they did here was they used a loop algorithm. This is actually Roger Melko's master's thesis. Using a loop algorithm, they were able to speed up the relaxation time within their simulations, and they were able to find a ground state that would happen at a very low temperature that was not experimentally observed. And so you can see that there could be a ground state. Instead of having just complete the tetrahedra being in a two-in, two-out ground state, you can actually get a unit cell, which is a 2x2 tetrahedra unit cell, and a pattern can form in which you can get long-range order. But the problem is, if this is, say, a 10 Kelvin barrier to relaxation for the spins, that experimentally it couldn't be observed because the process would be so slow. It's exponentially slowing down, and so by this point, the process was too slow to observe. So they predict an unattainable phase transition.
The peak
Yeah. Okay. So the monopole picture then became very made things even more interesting. And so the idea there is that, and maybe all of you know this, but anyways, the idea is there's two spins, two out. When you have a single excitation, you create a 3-1-1-3 state. And then the interesting thing that happens is that a single spin flip can split these apart, and the pluses and minus can wander apart. And I would say that the interesting thing is that Rishkin came up with this, but kind of was overlooked. And the 2008 is really when this hit the media, I guess, or the community. But if you look back, Rishkin had a result in 2005 in probably a less...
It's called a natural phenomenon.
What's that?
It's called natural phenomenon.
What's the natural phenomena?
Nature.
You know, yeah, okay. I was going to say, it always seems that the Russians get overlooked when it comes to things, but yeah. Yeah, maybe it also is a nature. So this is this neat thing where these things can split apart, and then the pluses and the minuses can wander apart, and there's going to be a population of pluses and minuses that's dependent on the temperature. The colder you are, the less creation of these you have, and then they're annihilating by wandering apart. And then Castelnuovo, in their paper, shows that there's a Coulomb interaction between these. Okay, so then, so this is a Coulomb interaction. And there's a Joubert and Holdsworth show a Monte Carlo simulation where they're looking at kind of effects of screening of these monopoles. And we see this paper here, that's also, I think, it was in Nature. What happens is they're taking the Schiffer data and they're putting a fit. So now they plot it as one, not as T instead of 1/T. And they're showing that the blue line is a simple model without the screening effects. And then with screening, you can get it to match up closer to the experiment, okay? And so the X's are, I think, the theory, and the dots are the experiment, or no, vice versa, okay? And so this looks like a pretty good match. But if when you plot it the way that Schiffer did, 1/T, you see there's actually a mismatch in the slopes and the energy barrier to relaxation, okay? And so the slopes at low temperatures are different. So what we did was set out an experiment to use our squid to go to lower frequencies and lower temperatures to figure out what the barrier to relaxation is, and to basically challenge the theory to see whether, well, what was the experiment wrong, or was the theory need some corrections? So basically add some extra information. So that's one of the things we set out to do, okay? What happens is some groups came up with different ways of measuring it using thermal relaxation, and they were able to extend the time response of this dysprosium titanate to lower temperatures and frequencies. So instead of using a squid, they're using a DMAG technique where they magnetize and then demagnetize the sample and look at the energy being released, and they can figure out a time constant from that. And they found an agreement in, they found two time constants within the system, one that agrees with the Joubert-Holdsworth theory, and another one that kind of matches up with the experiment. So they kind of have one foot in each camp here. And then some funny stuff happens at lower temperatures. Another result is there's this magnetricity model of the motion of the monopoles. And there's this squid measurement by Bramwell's group. Giblin did this. And they also did a MuSR measurement in here. And they match these two together to find that they can determine the charge of this magnetricity. And there's some issues with this data on both fronts. The MuSR, there's a paper by Dunsinger et al., which strongly suggests that it's actually the silver sample holder of the MuSR measurement that's producing all of the results. And so there's a pretty vigorous debate between these two groups. On the squid measurement, I've got problems with this, and that is that this is the magnetic relaxation. What they're doing is they're turning on a field, and then they're turning it off, and they're looking at the magnetic response. And so this is all the data that was needed to create this Nature paper, and it's kind of a problem. They're at 360 mK. They're turning on fields with different magnitudes, and they're looking at this time response, but it's only 180 seconds. And if you look at the Arrhenius plot and the Schiffer data, at 360 millik, the time response should be on the order of a year. And so 3 minutes is not enough to pick out the relaxation time. The other problem is a squid doesn't measure the absolute zero field. So they don't know that this is zero. They're honest in their paper assessing their data, but it's, you know, just because you're honest, I would say that's not enough. Like that zero is an arbitrary zero that's been just guessed upon. And so if you're doing a time constant fit to this with 3 minutes and you don't know if that zero is actually like four floors down or right at this floor, you have too many degrees of freedom to make a fit to determine what's happening. And so we set out to make this measurement work over longer timescales. Okay, so that's what we're doing. We're gonna see whether we can go and duplicate this or see what's happening. One of these is right, and also measure this over longer timescales and see whether this time is much different. Their response time is somewhere like here on this plot. So like orders of magnitude faster than what these groups were seeing. And so this is our squid setup. And it's, you know, I could talk about it later if you want, but basically we home make these things. There's about four groups in the world right now, as far as I know, that can make these kind of measurements. And we're one of them. It's kind of funny because maybe 10, 20 years ago, it was more common, but they're not commercially made anymore. John Wheatley's group would make these and sell them, but now you have to home make them to be able to make these measurements. And we have a homemade squid. This was actually an undergrad project to make a squid. Hallie did this, and so she lithographically patterned a squid. We drill a hole through the sample of silicon, and we can load a needle through there and then measure the magnetization or the susceptibility of a needle very accurately. And so those are the two systems. Okay, well, this is a homemade hand wound. There's a squid and there's the coil. The sample goes in there. And then this is this planar one where there's a needle of dysprosium titanate running through the substrate. The advantage of this is that there's a good field cancellation, so you can work at high fields where the squid doesn't have problems dealing with the big external field. And the other one is that the demagnetization correction on this should be much less significant because you have this long needle and the coil wrapped right around the center of it. This needle is long. This is half of it. The other half is going through the board and on the other side. Okay, this is our fridges. And this is our data. And so what we have here is a susceptibility as a function of frequency. And we going down to low frequencies, we pick up this chi double prime peak. And we then can determine the time constant of the dysprosium titanate. And this is the Schiffer data. And this is our data. And so we're extending it to lower temperatures. And we see a very similar slope to what they were seeing. There's an offset. And that's due to two things. They didn't do a demagnetization correction where the magnetic field around the sample is being altered by the actual magnetization of the sample. And as the sample is getting colder, that kind of effect can become more and more significant. But they also have an error of converting frequency from omega to F. And there's a 2 pi error that's in there. And that's what's causing a lot of that offset. Yeah. Another group, Matsuhira, they did a measurement at lower frequencies as well, more or less simultaneously with us. And they analyzed their data in a different way where they actually did a 2 Debye fit of their susceptibility, their chi double prime. And they found if you track two, this fits better to have two different relaxation times. And if you measure the time constants of the two as a function of one of the temperature, they track like this. And what I'm showing here is actually their data and our data simultaneously on top of each other. And you can see we have very good agreement. So not only are we getting very good agreement with this group on a different sample as a function of the time constant, but also the line shape is being described very similarly. So then we were looking at this and trying to understand what this double Debye relaxation could be. And we started collaborating with Patrick Henelius. He had a result looking at these kind of relaxation times on another work that we were doing, which is holmium yttrium lithium fluoride. And so I was talking to him about this and whether he can understand this relaxation process in the spin ice. And so then he didn't think that this double Debye was a good way of looking at it, but instead looks at a stretched exponential and has a function which he fits the chi double prime to that he can then transform to get the correlation function. And so what you can see here is a single Debye, double Debye, and then his function, which fits better. This is on a log graph, So it's fitting for a much, much larger portion of the data. Okay, and so then we're working with him on that. And this is our data compared to other theories where the slope is different. So one of the things we see is for some reason, all the theories have a much faster time constant for relaxation than we see, which agrees with Matsuhira's data as well.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
Stretched exponential will often mean glassiness.
Right.
So is that what is indicated here?
Well, that's a question. Yeah, why is it stretched? We don't know yet. I'll get to it. Okay? Not very well, but I'll bring it up a little bit more. Okay? Okay, so we tried to do this magnetization measurement to duplicate. This is the Bramwell's data with their time constants. We're saying that something must have dramatically happened. All these people are getting much faster time constants. If this line of our data continued, we'd be way up there. This is 10 to the 2 seconds, 10 to the 3. It will be up at 10 to the 7 seconds. We tried to do this, and we didn't see anything happening. So we don't see any dynamics at 360 millik, the temperature they're working at. There's just no response. The system is frozen. Okay, and so we couldn't duplicate their results. Okay, what we do see is if you turn on the field and off, you can see some response due to, let's say, eddy currents in the magnetic shields and stuff. And then there's kind of a ringing down of coils and stuff. And so you have to be very careful, the really early time response, that you're just not moving around circulating currents within the shields of your system. And also your magnet can have an inductance. So when you step up the field and you turn it down, there's a time constant for the coils to relax. So this is our data as a function of time, and we don't see long time constants. We went out to 1,000 seconds, and this is a log graph. And so we don't see the kind of fast 180, 10-second time constants that they were seeing. Okay, and so then with this is the idea of this relaxation being transformed to look at a correlation function. And then if we look at it this way, this lon, this is the way Patrick Henelius sets it up. I don't know if everybody does this, but this is where I learned about it. So when you plot it this way, the stretch will come out as the slope of this. And so this is the early time, this is ln of t, and this is the late time. And what we see is that there's a stretch here. If this was 1, then it would be no stretching. And so we're getting something like 0.8 or 0.7. And so there's a stretching over here. And then what we see is a long time tail. And all our data as a function of temperature has the same characteristic of a long time tail and stretching. So then what Patrick was doing is looking at Monte Carlo simulations to see what could be causing this. And what I was thinking was that if this is magnetricity and monopoles moving through the material, then it could be defects. And so what if this monopole hits a grain boundary? Then does that slow down the motion of the pluses and the minuses? And so it doesn't necessarily have to be glassy. It could just be defects in a real material. And so he did simulations for that and did not see that would speed things up or slow things down. Maybe that was a naive or a simplistic model, which doesn't look at how the crystal fields are affected, and just assuming each of the spins is actually just a perfect Ising spin in and out, but maybe they're actually not so simple, and a grain boundary maybe changes these things, okay? And so, but with the simplistic model, grain boundaries didn't do it. Then what happened was we were working on a terbium titanate and terbium titanate with Bruce Golan, and the stuffing is a common problem there. And what stuffing is where you have an excess of homiums, which are magnetic, and they're replacing the titanium sites. And so it could be that maybe there's some extra magnetic impurities in the system that are causing the monopoles to interact with those magnetic impurities. So he added those to the model. And what he found was that this long time tail would be produced by about a 0.3% stuffing. So if 0.3% of the sites have an extra homium in it, okay, then you can get exactly this kind of extent tail. The stretching, he found the stretching effect could be occurred by when he, for some reason, he would get rid of his, he just tried it, he got rid of his periodic boundary conditions. And then by getting rid of the periodic boundary conditions in his simulation, he ended up finding a stretch that would match ours. So that kind of, I would say, well, okay, that's a surface effect, but really maybe there's some density of grain boundaries. And that is a way of capturing the idea that you have boundaries every so often from, okay, where do you get, like a stacking fault is a very thermally activated process. thing when you're growing your crystal, you're going to naturally have stacking faults. And so I would think that maybe that could be explained by stacking faults within the material at a certain spacing. And so the stretching could be occurring from that.
But so you think stretching is not intrinsic?
I'm saying, right. I would think that it's a defect, and I would think that maybe stacking faults are what's doing that.
Because in highly frustrated system,
yeah,
even like regular FCC antiferromagnet, mm-hmm, when you quench it, you do see glassy behavior, mm-hmm, and some old numeric stretching behavior. So it could be intrinsic also.
It could be, right. It could be. I guess as the, you know, I'm thinking that these materials maybe aren't really so perfect. Mm-hmm. And so we should always suspect, you know, it's we should always be very careful that this, are we working with perfect samples? And so we've did this measurement. One of the things you say is like, why did Matsuhira get exactly the same shape as us, considering he had a different sample? And so just it could be surprising luck, or it's intrinsic, right? So that's something. Is it just very commonly to have a certain density of stacking faults? I don't know yet. We have to do, I would say right now, this is our result. What we're showing is that we have something that looks like a material defect effect, and we have a way of characterizing the potential defect density, either stuffing sites or maybe stacking faults. And what we need to do is get better materials and see whether we can identify this. So just like a residual resistance ratio in copper, as you cool it, there's electrical resistivity will flatten out when you hit the defect limit. Okay, this could be similar to a residual resistance in copper. And what we're seeing is that effect kick in. Okay, that's what I think this is. This stretching, yeah, I don't know. It could be that that's a stacking fault, or it could be something intrinsic. And so this is mapping the magnetization method, which we magnetize and demagnetize, mapping the susceptibility that's been transformed. And let's see if they're all three here. Maybe not all three. Yeah, there, and the simulations. And so they all have a kind of a qualitative characteristic that matches pretty well, okay? And there could be little offsets there, and that's maybe due to demagnetization correction. Our susceptibility, we can do a demagnetization correction, and our time domain, we can't. It's just the way susceptibility pinpoints a specific frequency, you know the susceptibility, then you can go and do a DMAG correction. While with the time domain, it's a mixture of all the different kinds of time responses and susceptibilities, and so it's not so straightforward. And so that could be the difference between our data on the offset in this direction. Okay, now this is something that, you know, you could talk to Patrick about, but basically what we did was we looked at then quantitatively the time response, not just the features, at low temperatures. And there's a difference in the time constants that we see from him and us. And when he noticed this, is that when you take the reciprocal of this, you can find that, or the ratio of these, I mean, you find that it can be explained for some reason if he changes the attempt frequency for his measurement and makes it go as 1/temperature. And so for whatever reason, if that attempt frequency scales with the monopole density or the temperature, then he can get it to match up. Okay, so that's the conclusion of the susceptibility, and that was published here. And then, how much time do I have?
Well, about 5 minutes now.
Okay, great. Okay, so then this is the specific heat measurements we're doing. And so this is the specific heat from Ramirez. And this I've explained already. There's the residual entropy. And if you look at the C/T for Roger's work, you can look at the entropy change. And the idea would be that you would have this plateau. And then if you can go to lower temperatures, you would see the rest of the entropy leave the system. And let's see, what is this? This is, I'm not sure what that's there for. But okay. Let me go to this. So the idea is that we're looking at this specific heat measurement. The idea is that we are thinking about the magnetic relaxation time of our susceptibility measurement and how it's getting very, very slow on the order of thousands of seconds at low temperatures. And so then when you look at the publications, did these people wait long enough for the heat to enter the system and leave the system? Or was it similar to the magnetization measurement where you turn on the field and you turn off the field too quickly and you're actually not measuring the true magnetization of the sample because the magnetic, it didn't relax. And so if you look at the measurements, this is Ramirez. He had a 15 second time window for letting the heat in and out. And so if we look at the susceptibility as a guide for the time constant, that would mean that below around 0.55 Kelvin, he is not letting enough time for the heat to enter and leave. Okay, so he's not waiting long enough. There's another group, Klemke, that later on they went to 600 seconds, and that's around this time. So the system's getting so slow that this work is in better thermal equilibrium, but below this temperature, I would say that they didn't wait long enough either. Okay, so what we do is we set up an experiment to try to measure this at very long time constants to see whether we can see this ordering occurring, and maybe we can see an onset of an upturn. Maybe we can't get all the way around because it'll be too slow, but this is going to zero. And as an experiment, the thing is seeing something deviate from zero isn't so hard, you know. So we just have to see an upturn in that slope, and we are indicating that a transition is starting to occur. And so there's another group. Oh, this is Rogers, and there's other specific heat measurements that were done. These time constants weren't given, but they've got some kinds of errors, but they're seeing qualitative effects. This is another group. Okay, and so yeah, there's a lot of different groups that are getting this characteristic, but it all flattens out. Okay, and so then we set out to do this with our measurement, and we set up a very long time constant, and what we see is this. This is the window that other people were using. And if we go to a very long time window, here 600 seconds, that's the Klemke, okay? And so this is the relaxation. We step down the heat, the temperature of the fridge, and we look at the heat being released, and we see the heat leaving the sample. And so from that, we can determine the change in the energy and the heat capacity from that. But when we go to really long time constants, we see there's a switchover, and there's a long time constant of heat being released at very long times. So this is 60,000 seconds. This is on a log graph. So although this is a very small amount of heat, it persists for a very long time, and that will give an underestimate of what the heat capacity is. And so this is our lowest temperature data where we held the fridge for this. We allowed heat to go in for 200,000 seconds, and then we lower the temperature of the fridge, and we look at the heat being released over the 200,000 seconds. And so that's like 880,000 seconds is about a day. And so we're seeing about a picowatt of heat leaving the sample at this point. But if we integrate all of that, the watts over the time, that gives the energy change. And so then we can see that there is a transition that's occurring. So this is our heat capacity when we wait long enough, and we can actually see an upturn. So it's a little bit, it's qualitatively similar, and we're seeing an upturn. We're seeing the entropy leaving the system for something at lower temperatures, but it's a little bit different that this didn't go straight down to zero and then back up. So it's occurring a little higher temperature than expected. Okay, so it's similar but different. And this is what we did, was another sample with powder. Powders are known to be better, and so we measured it, but there's a longer time constant thermal coupling between the grains, but what we could see is that it still has an upturn at lower temperatures, and so it's different than these measurements. And then what we did was we analyzed our data in a fast way, and we can reproduce what they were getting if we only look at the short time window. Okay, so then when you look at the entropy versus temperature, you can see that we punch through this Pauling residual entropy, and it continues going down. Okay, so then some ordering is occurring. Now, one of the things is the neutron scattering doesn't see this kind of ordering, but the time scales for this is maybe days to let it relax. And so now this is a guide for the neutron scatterers and USR people, is that they go to these beam lines, they have, let's say, 3 days of measuring. What they need to do is cool the sample down and then roll it in front of the beam and allow it to relax. And another thing they do, and this is very common, is that they'll go down to the lowest temperature they can, because they feel that the lower the temperature, the faster it'll get down to that temperature. But in reality, they've quenched it. The time constant has actually become very, very long at that point, and they've just frozen it into a higher temperature state. So really, they've got to come up with a cooling curve to optimally get it the entropy out, to be able to identify this ordering. And so then this is a time constant we see with our thermal relaxation, and it matches up with the susceptibility more or less. Even at our lowest temperatures, though, it's deviating from this Arrhenius. So maybe here we had to wait even longer. It's hard to get a time constant if you don't have many. You need to have a curve that's multiple time constants of what you're looking for. And so maybe we had to wait not 200,000 seconds, but 800,000 seconds, and our fit would have been, you know, given us something more accurate. Okay, this is a new result that just got accepted. And so what we did was collaborating with this group here. So Castelnuovo and Joff, they have an idea that maybe instead of magnetic stuffing, the idea is that it's oxygen, there's an oxygen deficiency. And what it's doing is it's changing the titanium plus four into a titanium plus three that could be magnetic. And so what they did was they gave us two sets of samples, one that was annealed in oxygen and one that was not. And what we did was we measured it at a temperature. And so this is this Lawn method of looking at the stretching. And what we can see, if you're three things here, this is our original McMaster sample. And so you see it curves. Okay, so we see the long time tail and the stretch. But then when we see the unannealed, it matches that very nicely. But the annealed one goes straight. So we got rid of this long time tail and due to the oxygen. So it's actually maybe not due to stuffing, but it's actually due to magnetic impurities, trace of magnetic impurities from an oxygen deficiency. And so I would say, I'll conclude here. The idea is that what we're seeing is at long time constants, you have to do these measurements very patiently. That goes not only to specific susceptibility, but to the MuSR and neutron scattering. We see sample dependence, at least at this level, where we have to be careful about stuffing and oxygen concentrations because it's affecting the long time tail and must have other effects. On the other hand, the stretching didn't change. And so oxygen annealing wouldn't change the stacking faults and things like that. And so that could still be defects, or it could be intrinsic to the system. But we did get this part here is going to be due to magnetic impurities. Okay?
Is it due to oxygen diffusion or just dynamics of the spin of titanium?
So it's going to be the titanium becomes magnetic because it's got a different, right. Yeah, but not diffusion. It's just they're frozen in there. And they're just now, there's some magnetic sites there. And the idea is that the monopoles moving through will then have a different amount of energy for either creation or existing near those magnetic sites. Okay? And so I would assume this, you know, is that if we, this is just like residual resistance, I would think, we have a certain population of monopoles moving through and a certain population of these impurities, and there must be some crossover and also the spacing. If we get cold enough, we probably would see that this sample would have a long time tail as well. And I would say what's interesting now, you know, we did this work. The next thing to do is to measure the specific heat on the sample. And one of the things is maybe we'll see this upturn still. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. But the other thing is that because the long time tail is not there, it'll allow us to be able to go and get the heat out of the system faster. And so we'll be able to maybe go lower in temperature for the specific heat measurement. And so that's what our next measurement is. Okay? And I think that's it. Thanks.
Any questions?
Sure. Yeah. So in this other interface, whether there is a kind of anisotropic susceptibility one can observe.
Anisotropic susceptibility. What do you mean?
Maybe a different orientation.
Right. Yeah. When I first started this, I was thinking that would be very, you know, we're in a very, very low excitation, and so we're in a region which seems to be not dependent on the orientation. If we went to higher fields, I'm sure it would become important. We're working at a milligauss, so we're working at very, very small excitations. Now, one way we checked the orientation dependence anyways, and we didn't see any difference. Okay. One of the things is that if there was an orientation dependence, if we were looking at the chi double prime as a function of frequency and temperature on a powder sample versus a single crystal, if there was a significant difference, we would see a width difference, and we don't. So at least at this level, there a powder sample would be all orientations. And so if there was a difference, we would have seen a broader distribution. And so at this temperature, we don't, and fields, we don't see anything. But that's another thing that we're looking at is starting to work at higher fields and studying, I guess there's this Kagome things that can happen. And so we would be looking at higher fields and different kinds of ordering and stuff in the system, but not this. This is Milligauss.
Since the inspiration came from realize,
right? Yeah.
I remember some old data on relaxation in ice, low temperature.
Right.
So do they see similar thing? Or is it?
I don't think they see anything. There's the time constants for this. I think in regular ice would be extremely long. I was looking up just some papers, mm-hmm. and the idea is like if maybe there's like a glacier that's really really old ice. You can look at. Yeah, why not? And look at the structure of that. But I think what they find is that impurities changes the state and becomes extremely sensitive to ice, you know, impurities within the ice. And so that would be, I'm not sure how, you know, careful the studies are. And I was just going through it as a layman, and you have to be careful because there could be
plenty of ice outside.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of crackpots that write papers on ice, right? So the problem is I have to go talk to a real ice expert and not just go through the web and find some 13-year-old that wrote something, right? So I would say I don't know yet about water ice. I have to go through the literature of that more carefully.
I think potassium dope water ice shows increased relaxation dynamics.
That's what I saw, some kind of doping stuff. But I would say that I wasn't able to read these things in a critical way where I could, you know, trust my impression of it. But yeah, I can see all sorts of results in water ice. Yeah.
One of your graphs, the time constant became flat as a function of temperature. Some temperature.
Right.
In some situations, they imply quantum effect. You know, when you go to low temperatures.
Yeah. So you're talking about this plateau region and the intermediate temperature. So I think the idea there behind that is that you're in a state where the icing nature of the system is kicked in. You're cold enough, but you have the 4004 state as a possible excitation as well.
So it need not be quantum.
No, I think that's the region where you're two in, two out, and then your excited state being 3113 is beyond that now. You've got the 4-0 states in there as well, and that's what's happening there. So it's very, very, that's a high temperature phase.
Yeah, my question, you know, if this monopole are moving around, whether if they cross the circuit or sample,
yeah,
whether that will cause some bigger noise.
Yeah, well, one of the questions, what happens to the spins on the surface? Because we have this model where we have these Ising-like characteristic and the crystal fields, but what's happening on the boundary conditions really of the sample? Yeah. And it could be completely different. So it's not like it's perfectly the same spin until you get to the end, and then I don't know what happens.
So boundary could behave like a barrier monopole.
Yeah, and so actually now there's this work I know that like Bramwell's doing on thin films, where they're depositing thin films of samples. And he was asking me to measure the specific heat of the thin film. But the problem with that is that you have very little material to detect. And also, I would say that the damage on a thin film could be very, very high. And so the quality of the material on the surfaces could be really, it's not the same as the bulk. And if you machine this and you cut it, there can be all sorts of damage as well. So I would say that the surface stuff is very interesting. Experimentally, it'll take some work to make sure that we're doing that properly.
More questions? I have one quick question. Okay. So regarding this difference in the upturn, you see that sort of lower higher temperatures and a bigger upturn than Roger's prediction. Is there any theory understanding to explain that difference?
So I think Michelle has been working with Patrick Hanelius on that. And I'm not certain what the status of that is, but I think they're looking at the interactions. There's like the nearest neighbor model and then further interactions. And I think that they can come up with ways where they can describe those features. On the other hand, I don't know if Taran's here, but Taran? No. So he's been working on this, and I'm not certain what the status of that, whether it's published or not, so I wouldn't say. But basically, they're working on that, and they have models which can, you know, that they're working on. But they're also working on coupling that to other measurements and stuff. So they're working on it. And you talk to Michelle, talk to Taran about that.
All right, so let's thank Jan again.